Maddox, Luther stood and brought his rifle up to his shoulder and was about to fill me with holes when a shotgun blast filled the room, and Luther seemed to defy gravity as he lifted off his feet and slammed into the wall. Before he dropped, Kate fired a second time, and Luther's lower jaw disappeared. I again lunged at Maddox, who was now on one knee, facing me with his Colt 45 in his hand. He started to raise his gun, and Kate shouted, "Freeze! Freeze! Drop it! Drop it or you're dead!" There was this long moment while Bane Maddox considered his options. Kate helped him decide by blowing a hole in the ceiling above his head. Before the plaster even hit him, he dropped his gun. Time sort of hung there for a while, with Maddox and I both on our knees facing each other from about 5 feet away. Kate was standing about 10 feet away, the shotgun pointing at Maddox's head. The room smelled of burned explosives, and a blue smoke hung in the air. My eyesight was returning, but black specks danced around wherever I looked. As for my hearing, I'd heard the shotgun blasts, but they'd sounded far away, and if there was any other noise in the room, I couldn't detect it. I stood slowly and got my footing, then grabbed Maddox's 45 off the carpet and went over to Luther, who was sitting against the wall near the door. He was not dead, but would wish he was if he survived without a lower jaw. Kate's first shot had shredded his arm, but his rifle was still hanging by its sling across his chest, so I pulled it away from him and set the selector switch from full automatic to safety, then I slung the rifle over my shoulder. Kate had motioned Maddox onto the rug, where he was lying with his face buried in the thick blue plush carpet, which I could tell him firsthand was not comfortable. I glanced at the countdown clock and saw we had 2 full minutes before 0000. I needed to do this by the book, to be sure there was no one left who presented a danger to Kate or me. So I went over to Carl, who was still alive and who also had some parts of his face where they didn't belong. I started to frisk him, but amazingly, he sat up, like Frankenstein on the laboratory table, and I backed off. I watched him get to his feet. Clearly, he was blind. Not temporarily blinded, but, judging from the burns around his eyes, permanently blind. Nevertheless, he put his hand inside his jacket and brought out a Colt 45 automatic. I was going to say drop it, but then he'd know where to fire, so with time running out, I made a difficult decision and put a 45 bullet through his forehead. He was too big to be lifted off his feet, and he fell backward, like a huge tree toppling. Kate said, 58 seconds. I walked over to Maddox, who was staring at Carl's body, and asked him, how do I stop this? He turned his head toward me and replied, fuck you. Do you have anything intelligent to say? Come on, Bane. Help me. How do I stop this? You can't. And why do you want to? John, think about this. I have to be honest and admit that I had been thinking about it. I mean, God help me, but I did think about letting it happen. Kate called out, 40 seconds. I got my head back on straight and remembered what Maddox had said about the ELF signal, and I seemed to recall something about a continuous signal and a lock-in period, so I thought that if I stopped the ELF wave right here at the transmitter, the receivers wouldn't or couldn't lock in and send a signal to the nuclear detonators. Electronics is not one of my strong points, but destruction is, and there was nothing to lose, except 2 cities, so I stepped back and told Kate to do the same. The countdown clock read 15 seconds, but I recalled from Bane that the ELF wave and the decoding could be a minute or two faster or slower in reaching the receivers, and for all I knew, the 2-minute lock-in time was already running, or finished. I glanced at the 3 flat-screen TVs, but there was nothing unusual happening in San Francisco, Los Angeles, or Washington. Kate said, "John." I looked where she was staring and saw that the countdown clock read 0000, and the black LED box was now flashing, "God, God, God." I raised the Colt 45 and pointed it at the ELF transmitter. Maddox had gotten up and was on his knees now, in front of the transmitter, as though he were protecting it. He held his hands up and shouted, "John, don't do it. Let it happen. I beg you. Save the world. Save America." I fired 3 rounds over Maddox's head into the transmitter, and 3 more into the rest of the electronic console, just to be sure. Then Kate blasted the last 2 shotgun rounds into the smoking electronics. The lights, dials, and instruments blinked off, and the big metal console smoked and sparked. The word God blinked out. Maddox had turned his head and was looking at the dying ELF transmitter. Then he turned to me. Then Kate, then back to me, and said in almost a whisper, "You ruined everything. You could have let it happen. Why are you so stupid?" I had a few good replies for him about duty, honor, and country, and also about, "If I'm so stupid, why do I have your gun?" But I got right to the point and said, "This is for Harry Muller," and fired my last bullet into his brain. Chapter 51. We found the key in Carl's pocket and removed our shackles. We also found his Colt 45 on the floor, and Kate stuck it in her waistband. Kate and I stood side by side in the smoky room, as mute as the 3 televisions that we were watching. My heart, and I'm sure hers, was thumping. After a few minutes of commercials, with no urgent bulletins or screens going black in L.A. or San Francisco, I said to Kate, "I guess everything is okay." She nodded. I asked her, "Are you okay?"
"I'm fine. I'm just stunned."
I let a few minutes go by, then said to her, "You did a good job."
"Good? I did a fucking excellent job."
"Excellent job." I asked, "Hey, where did you hide the bear banger?"
"You don't want to know."
"Right." After another minute of silence, she asked me,
"Do you believe this? Do you believe what Maddox was going to do?"
I looked at the electronic console and said, "Desperate times call for desperate measures." She didn't respond for a second, then said,
"John, for a minute there, I thought you were wavering a little."
I thought about that. Honestly?
"Don't answer."
But I had to say something, so I said, "It's going to happen anyway."
"Don't say that."
I tried a joke. "Why don't we stay down here for a few years?" She didn't reply. I glanced at Bain Maddox, who was still in a kneeling position, but now with his head thrown back, resting on the edge of his electronic console table. Those gray hawk eyes were wide open, as unblinking and emotionless as ever. And, except for the red hole in the middle of his forehead, I could hardly tell he was dead, which was creepy. Kate saw me staring at him.
"You did what you had to do."
Which we both knew was not true. I did what I wanted to do. I looked away from Maddox and watched the 6 security monitors, but I didn't see anyone, except for a shadow moving around in the gatehouse, and I guessed that was Derek. Then I saw a Jeep pass in front of the generator house. I said to Kate, "They're still out there, and no one has arrived from State Police headquarters." She nodded.
"So, we'll stay here a while."
I really didn't feel like hanging around this room much longer with 2 stiffs on the floor and a smoldering carpet and couch plus the smell of burnt electronics. Also, Luther was gurgling, and I recognized that sound. There wasn't much I could do for him, but I thought maybe I should try. So I looked around for a landline phone to call state police headquarters to get an ambulance, not to mention some state troopers to arrest Derek and whoever else needed to be arrested and get us the hell out of there. Kate kept staring at the three television sets and glancing at a clock on the wall.
I really think it's okay.
Yeah. I couldn't find a phone, and I thought about trying another room, and that reminded me of the room with the closed door where I'd heard a television. I mean, I was still a little punchy from the bear bangers, but I should have been more alert. Also, my hearing had not fully returned, and neither had Kate's, so we never heard anyone coming down the corridor, and the first I knew that we weren't alone was when I heard a voice say, "Well, I didn't expect this." I spun around, and standing by the door was the ghost of Ted Nash. I was speechless. Kate, too, stood across the room, staring, and her mouth actually dropped open. Finally, I said, "You're dead." He replied, "Actually, I'm feeling fine. Sorry to upset you." "I'm not upset. I'm disappointed." "Be nice, John." He looked at Kate and asked her, "So, how are you?" She didn't answer. I knew I saw the hand of the CIA in this, but in my worst nightmare, I never thought I'd see Ted Nash again. Or maybe I did. Nash scanned the room but didn't comment on the destruction. The blood splattered all over. Luther dying a few feet from him, or Carl lying dead in the middle of the floor. Ted was a cool guy. He did, however, look at Bane Maddox and said, "That's a real shame." Apparently, we had different opinions of the deceased. Nash said, not to us but to himself, "Well, there are going to be a lot of disappointed people in Washington." Neither Kate nor I responded. But I thought about getting the M16 unslung from my shoulder and into the firing position. I wasn't being totally paranoid because Ted Nash is probably a killer, and for sure not a big fan of John Corey. Plus, he was wearing a sport jacket, and he had his right hand stuck inside, like the pretty boy fashion models in the catalogs. This was the nonchalant gun-in-my-pocket look. Kate finally spoke.
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm working."
You were in the North Tower.
"Actually, like you, John, and other people, I was late." He said philosophically, "Isn't it funny how fate works?" I replied, "Yeah, fate is a barrel of laughs. What's the deal, Ted? Are you going to tell me you're here to stop Maddox, but once again you were a few minutes late?" He smiled and replied, "I'm not here to stop Maddox." He glanced again at the late Mr. Maddox. "But apparently you were. I was just here for dinner." Then, before we could engage in any more witty repartee, he pulled his pistol, which was a Glock similar to my own, and said, "You guys really fucked things up." "No, Ted. We just saved San Francisco and Los Angeles." I said, to be sure he understood, "We're heroes. The bad guys are dead." He was getting a little pissed, the way he always does with me, and now that he had his gun out and we all knew where he stood on this issue, he said, "You have no idea how you've fucked things up." He stared at me and glanced at Kate. "The world as we know it was about to be forever changed. Do you understand that? Do you?" He was getting himself all worked up, so I didn't answer his stupid question. He went on, "This was the best, most ingenious, most daring and courageous plan we have ever come up with. In one fucking day. One day, John. One fucking day, We could have wiped out a major threat to America. And you, you and this bitch here, fucked it up. Hey, I'm really sorry. Kate took a deep breath and said sharply, First of all, Ted, I'm not a bitch. Second, if this government wants to destroy Islam with atomic weapons, or threaten to destroy them, then they should have the balls to do that without faking a fucking terrorist attack on two American cities and killing millions of Americans. Shut the fuck up. Who gives a shit about Los Angeles and San Francisco? Not me. Not you either. Don't take the moral high ground with me, Kate. We had a chance here to bring this Muslim shit to a happy conclusion. But you and this fucking clown you're married to... He glanced at me and for the first time noticed the sling on my shoulder and the black muzzle of the M16 peeking up from behind my back. He pointed the Glock at me. Get that fucking rifle off your shoulder. Don't touch it. Don't touch anything. Let it slide to the floor. Now. I leaned left so that the sling started to slide off my shoulder and down my arm, while trying to figure out how to get a grip on the rifle, click off the safety, aim from the hip, and get off one good shot. Apparently, Mr. Nash was tired of my slow response and said, Don't bother. Just stand there and die. He aimed his Glock at my chest. Just so you know, I pulled some strings to get you sent here, and hopefully killed, instead of poor Harry Muller, who you will be joining in about 3 seconds. Also, he nodded toward Kate. I did screw her. I heard a loud blast, but didn't see his muzzle flash. He did, however, toss his gun into the air, or so it seemed. His body went straight back as though he'd been kicked in the chest, and he slammed into the wall next to Luther. As he was sliding to the floor, Kate emptied Carl's Colt 45 into Ted Nash's body, which jerked violently each time another bullet hit him. I watched her get off the last 3 shots, and there was nothing hysterical or frenzied about the way she was shooting. She was holding the big automatic with both hands in the correct grip, knees bent, arms straight, aim centered, squeeze, fire, breathe, hold it, squeeze, and so forth, until the slide locked in the empty position. I went over to her to take the pistol, but she threw it aside. I said, Thanks. She kept staring at Nash's body, covered now with blood and gore from a head wound. She said, Not a bitch, Ted. I'd have to remember not to use that word when we argued. Chapter 52. I found a landline phone and called Major Schaefer, who, as it turned out, was totally clueless about where we were or what was going on. I gave him a very edited, need-to-know briefing, mentioning murder and mayhem, and requesting troopers, an ambulance, a CSI team, and his presence. Kate and I, carrying Luther's fully loaded M16 and Nash's thankfully fully loaded Glock, explored and secured the other rooms in the subterranean living quarters, which could have been featured in better homes and fallout shelters. We found the canvas bag with our stuff in it and got ourselves back together. There's nothing interesting or educational about being a helpless prisoner, especially if your jailers are psychotic and homicidal. So I never quite understood the Stockholm syndrome thing, where the prisoner starts to identify with his or her captor and begins to sympathize with whatever bullshit the captor is using as an excuse for his bad behavior. Now and then, however, what the psycho is doing or saying actually does appeal to what the prisoner already believes or has thought about himself in the dark parts of his mind. But enough about that. Kate and I found Mr. Maddox's barroom, which was actually a smaller version of the one upstairs, and she liberated a bottle of Dom Perignon, vintage 1978, which she opened and drank from a water tumbler. I found some warm bottles of Karlstadt beer, which doesn't improve with age, and in fact had gotten a little cloudy since 1984, but it hit the spot. Regarding Mr. Ted Nash, this was his second and hopefully last time back from the dead. I counted seven. Count 'em. Seven holes in him, which was not bad for eight shots. In fact, I felt silly feeling for a pulse, and Kate asked me what the hell I was doing. But I needed to be really sure. Also regarding Ted Nash, in less than 3 minutes, he'd managed to totally piss me off. First, I'm not a clown, Ted, and my wife is not a bitch. As for the other thing, well, it happened. Even Kate can make a mistake with men. I'm sure not all of her boyfriends were John Corey's. She must have guessed what I was thinking about, and she finished another glass of champagne and said, "It never happened. He was lying." Well, I couldn't ask dead Ted, so I let it go. CIA guys lie, I said. Believe me. She had Ted's Glock, so I said, I believe you, sweetheart. Being a lawyer and an FBI agent, she informed me, I can explain the first and second shot as self-defense. I can't explain the other six shots. I suggested, let's say Ted challenged you to hit him eight times. I added, actually, I'd be happy to take the rap, or the credit for killing him. Thanks, but I'll handle it. We moved back into the ELF room to check the security monitors, and we saw Schaefer's guys arriving in marked and unmarked cars, with an ambulance, all lined up on McEwen Pond Road behind the closed gate. Oddly, the gate was an opening, and the lead car smashed through it. Then, two uniformed troopers went into the gatehouse, and a few minutes later, two EMS guys from the ambulance carried a body on a stretcher out of the gatehouse and back toward the ambulance. Kate asked me, "What's that about?" "I'm pretty sure Derek is dead."
"Dead?"
"Yeah. Maddox needed him to tidy up the lodge and get rid of the van I borrowed from Rudy. But Maddox didn't want Derek talking about that, or talking about where everyone was in the fallout shelter. So he got someone to get rid of Derek." Kate commented, "Bane Maddox seems to think of everything." "Not everything, and not anymore." We gave it 15 minutes to be sure that the right people were in charge upstairs, then made our way to the spiral staircase, found the hydraulic switch to raise the card table, and ascended into the card room, where the air was fresh. We had our creds out, and we were passed from one state trooper to another, until we found ourselves in the great room, where Major Schaefer had set up his command post with a radio and a few troopers. Kaiser Wilhelm was sleeping and farting near the hearth. Schaefer asked us, "What in the name of God is going on here?" I replied, "The murder of Harry Muller is solved. Bane Maddox and Carl the butler did it."
"Yeah?
Where's Maddox?"
"In the fallout shelter."
"We searched the whole basement." I explained how to find the fallout shelter and added, "You got three dead down there, and one seriously wounded."
"Who's dead?"
"Maddox, Carl, and some other guy."
"Maddox is dead?
How did he die?" I answered evasively, "Get your CSI team there and let them get to work. Also, the wounded guy needs help fast." Schaefer picked up his radio phone and gave instructions regarding the fallout shelter. I also advised Schaefer, "You should disarm and restrain the security guards." "They're disarmed and confined to their barracks under guard."
"Good.
What do we have on them?" "Accessories or witnesses to Harry's murder. Tell them the boss is dead and see if they'll start talking. He nodded, then said to us, those three diesel engines and generators were running at full capacity and we shut them down. Do you know anything about that? I replied, well, as it turned out, Fred was right. Submarines.
What?
Kate said, sorry, Major. This comes under the category of national security.
Yeah?
I changed the subject back to homicide and informed Schaefer, don't bother looking for Putyoff here.
Why not?
Well, according to the late Mr. Maddox, he murdered his house guest, Dr. Putyoff, then put the body through the wood chipper.
What?
If it matters, Putyoff got what he deserved. But I can't get into that. I suggested, you may want the CSI guys to pay special attention to the wood chipper. If they don't find anything there, you might think about collecting some bear shit and see if you can find a little of Dr. Putyov's DNA there. Schaefer said, I'm not quite following. Hey, I asked, what happened to the guy in the gatehouse?
He's dead.
Derek, right?
That's what his name tag said.
He informed us, the EMS guys thought it looked like poisoning. Maybe a neurotoxin. The guy was twitching like an epileptic before he died. I said to Kate, geez, I hope it wasn't the pigs in the blanket.
Schaefer replied, we didn't find any pigs in the blanket, but there was a fresh pot of coffee in the guardhouse, and this guy had a spilled coffee mug on his desk.
So we're thinking the coffee. We'll test it and do the toxicology.
Kate said to me, Maddox does plan ahead.
Not anymore.
Kate asked Schaefer, are the FBI here?
Oh, yeah. They set up their own command post. He jerked his head upward and said, in Maddox's office, your buddy Griffith is there, and he's still looking for you.
Kate suggested, let's go say hello.
Okay. I said to Schaefer, see you later. He looked at us and said, you smell like smoke, and you look like hell. What happened? I replied, it's like a really long and very weird story. Let me get back to you on that. He reminded us, you must remain on the scene to assist with the investigation. See you later. I took Kate's arm and we left the great room. There were about a dozen uniformed state troopers going through the house, obviously without knowing what they were supposed to be doing. I flashed my creds and asked one of them, where's the kitchen?
Kitchen?
Oh, you just go down this hallway.
Thanks.
I headed for the kitchen, and Kate said to me, we need to see Liam Griffith.
Schaefer said he was in the kitchen.
In Maddox's office. I tapped my ear. Come again? We found the kitchen, which was unoccupied. I noticed that there was no sign of dinner preparations, and I pointed this out to Kate, who replied, I think dinner was a ruse, John.
Yeah? No steak and potatoes?
Why are we here?
Because I'm hungry.
Can I get you a cup of coffee from the gatehouse?
Sure.
And get one for yourself. I opened the big industrial-sized refrigerator and found some cheese and cold cuts. How can you eat? She asked me. My stomach is churning.
I'm hungry.
I threw the cheese and cold cuts on the counter, then went to the kitchen sink and washed up. I think I had some Maddox on me. As I was doing this, Mr. Liam Griffith entered the kitchen and asked us, where the hell have you two been? I looked up from the sink. Could you hand me that dish towel? He hesitated, then handed it to me. What are you doing here? I dried my face and replied, we've been saving the planet from nuclear destruction.
Really?
Then what did you do for an encore? I handed the towel to Kate, who went to the sink to wash up. I said to Griffith, well, then we killed a buddy of yours. I unwrapped the cheddar cheese and said, Ted Nash. Mr. Griffith did not reply. But I could see from his face that he wasn't understanding me. Finally, he said, Ted Nash,
is dead. That's what I said. Doesn't that sound great? He still wasn't comprehending what I was saying, so I was pretty sure that Liam Griffith, prick though he was, had no clue about any of this. Kate dried her hands and face. He didn't die in the North Tower. But he's dead now. She added, I killed him. What? I said, we will not say anything else on that subject at this time. Do you want some cheddar cheese? Huh? No. Finally, he said to us, as you know, you're both in major trouble. I have orders to escort you back to the city as soon as I locate you, which I've done. I have the pleasure to inform you that you are both the subject of possible disciplinary action, and hopefully worse. And on and on. I must have eaten a half pound of cheese and cold cuts while he was rambling on, and I looked at my watch a few times as a hint that he should wrap it up. When he was through, he asked us, what exactly happened here? I replied, Kate and I found Harry Muller's killer. Who is it? Kate answered, it was Bane Maddox, the owner of this lodge. Where is he now? I said, in the fallout shelter. Dead. I added, I killed him. No reply. And that's all you need to know, and all we're saying. All right. Then I need you to come with me. Where are you going, Liam? I told you, back to the city. There's a helicopter waiting at the airport. I informed him, we really can't leave a crime scene. Major Schaefer, all right. The three of us will spend 1 hour here with the state police so you can explain what happened. Then, I need to insist that the police release you into my custody. I looked at Kate and she nodded. I said to Griffith, Kate and I will confine our statements to the subject of Harry Muller's murder. Everything else that you and the state police see here is a matter of national security, which will not be discussed until we're back at 26 Fed. Understand? Maybe you can give me a hint about how national security plays into Kate killing a CIA officer. Kate responded, Liam, I don't think your security clearance is high enough for me to tell you about that. He looked a little pissed, but got off a smart remark. Ted always spoke highly of you, Kate. Not the last time we spoke. Liam Griffith is no idiot and said, you're both either in deep trouble or you're going to get a commendation. So I'll just shut up until I find out which it's going to be. I commented, today must be your annual smart day. So we spent an hour with Major Schaefer, the state detectives, and the crime scene investigators, during which Kate and I danced around the central issue of what the hell was going on in the Führer bunker. Then, after a pissing match between Schaefer and Griffith, Kate and I got in Liam's rental car and began our drive from the lodge, which took us past the flagpole where the American flag still flew, illuminated by the spotlight. And below the stars and stripes was Bane Maddox's 7th Cavalry Regiment pennant. Yeah, I had mixed feelings about the guy, mostly negative, but, well, if he hadn't killed Harry, and if he hadn't been prepared to kill a few million other Americans, including Kate, me and anyone else who got in his way, plus a couple hundred million innocent men, women, and children. Well, he was a complex man, and it was going to take me a while to figure him out. We also passed by the wood chipper, and that sort of brought me back to reality. The big things, like nuclear Armageddon, were a little abstract. It's the small things, like the wood chipper, that make you understand evil. Well, we helicoptered back to New York City, and by the time we got to 26 Federal Plaza, there were about a dozen people there from the office, including, of course, Tom Walsh, and another dozen from Washington, all waiting for us with open notebooks and tape recorders. Tom Walsh greeted us warmly by saying, "What the fuck was I thinking when I sent you two up there?" I replied,
What were you thinking when you sent Harry up there? He had no answer for that, so I asked him, whose idea was it to send me up there alone on that assignment? No response. I informed him, I'll tell you. It was Ted Nash's idea. Nash is dead. He is now, and I'm not. Kate said to Walsh, but it could have easily gone the other way. Walsh looked at both of us, and I could see he was trying to figure out if he was supposed to be clueless, angry, or blameless. He couldn't seem to decide, so he went to the men's room. I could see that there was still a lot of confusion about what had happened and what our status was, heroes or felons, but I also sensed that one or two guys from Washington knew exactly what this was all about, but kept it to themselves. We were debriefed in Walsh's office by two-man relay teams for hours, but Kate and I held up pretty well as we gave the interviewers an hour-by-hour, blow-by-blow account of everything that had happened since we walked into 26 Federal Plaza on Columbus Day morning and spoke to Tom Walsh, including talking to Betty at Continental Commute Air and Max and Larry at the car rental desks, then checking out Maddox's jets at the General Aviation Office, then the decision to go to the Custer Hill Lodge instead of State Police Headquarters, and on and on. I could see that the FBI people were partly impressed by our initiative and good investigative techniques, and somewhat troubled by our total failure to follow orders and becoming fugitives. I hoped they were learning something. Also, I could sort of tell, as the night wore on, that Kate and I were the only ones there who weren't worried about something. Interestingly, most of the FBI interviewers seemed unhappy that Bain Maddox, the mastermind and prime witness to this conspiracy, was dead, and that I killed him. I said, of course, it was self-defense, though it was actually self-gratification. I mean, it was a stupid thing to do. And by whacking him, I complicated the investigation into the conspiracy. I wish I had it to do over again. Of course, I'd do the same thing, but I'd first remind myself that I wasn't acting professionally. Also, unless I was imagining things, at least two of the FBI guys from Washington did not seem that unhappy that Maddox was not able to talk. On the subject of Kate killing CIA officer Ted Nash, none of the FBI guys commented or pressed the questioning, which was odd but understandable. They weren't gonna touch that subject unless or until they heard from someone higher up. I had a little fun watching Tom Walsh squirm, and more fun sitting in his office with my feet on his conference table as Kate and I were debriefed. At about 3 a.m., I expressed a strong craving for Chinese food, and an FBI agent went out and found an open place. Hey, it's not every day you're the center of attention, and you have to milk it a little. There was a lot to unravel here, and I had no idea where this was going to go, or how high up the Project Green conspiracy reached. And, of course, neither Kate nor I would ever know. At dawn, two FBI agents drove us back to our apartment and told us to get a good night's sleep, even though it was morning. Back in our apartment, we stood on the balcony and watched the sun rising over Lower Manhattan, both remembering the morning of September 12th, 2001, when we'd watched the black smoke blocking out the sun not only for us and New York, but for the whole country. I said to Kate, as we know in this business, every act of violence and every murder is revenge for the murder before it and the excuse for the murder after it. She nodded and said, you know, I wanted to get out of this business, go someplace else. But now, after this, I want to stay here and do what I can. I looked at her, then back at Lower Manhattan, where we could once see the Twin Towers rising into the sky. I said to her, or myself, I wonder if we'll see the alert level go to green again in our lifetime. I doubt it.
But if we keep working at it, we can keep it from going red.
Bottom line, the FBI in Los Angeles and San Francisco found the pilots and co-pilots, and found the suitcase nukes in their hotel rooms. In fact, one of the co-pilots was sitting on one of them, watching TV when the FBI opened the door to his room. Bottom line, I got stuck with a $3,000 bill from the Point, and as Kate predicted, the accounting office didn't want to hear any explanations. Plus, Walsh wouldn't go to bat for us, so Kate and I are eating out less often for a while. We need to go to FBI headquarters in D.C. to be fully debriefed, give statements, and write reports. Regarding the executive board of the Custer Hill Club, the only news so far, reported in small items in the print media, is that the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Edward Wolfer, has taken a leave of absence. Paul Dunn, the presidential advisor on matters of national security, has resigned his position. And General James Hawkins has retired from the Air Force. These three events, taken by themselves, did not seem remarkable and caused no stir in the ever-vigilant news media. Meanwhile, Kate and I are waiting for more startling news about these guys, such as their arrests. But so far, Dunn, Wolfer, and Hawkins have not made the front page or the 6 o'clock news, and I wouldn't be surprised if we never heard another thing about them, despite what Kate and I told the FBI. Maybe they lost those notes. As for the fourth member of Maddox's board, CIA officer Scott Lansdale, no news is not necessarily good news. This guy is still out there somewhere, and Scott is either going to go scot-free or, if he's in big trouble, no one is ever going to hear about it. I mean, should we trust an organization that gets paid to lie? On another, perhaps related subject, the war with Iraq seems on track, and I'm taking Maddox's inside information and betting on the week of March 17th, which my bookie says is a long shot at 3-1 odds. If I can triple my $1,000 bet, I can cover the point. As for oil futures, my broker says that post-war Iraqi oil will flood the market, and prices are going down. Not up, as Maddox said. I have to think about who to trust. My stockbroker, or Bain Maddox. That's a tough call. One thing we did not have to do in Washington was explain how or why Kate killed a CIA officer. On that subject, the head CIA guy in the ATTF told us that the dead man found in the Custer Hill Lodge remained unidentified, and that the CIA officer named Ted Nash, whom we once knew, had died in the North Tower on September 11th, 2001. I wasn't about to argue with them about that, and neither was Kate. I do think about Maddox's Project Green a lot, and I'm pretty sure that what almost happened, an attack on an American city or cities with weapons of mass destruction, is going to happen sooner or later. But now, I'd have to wonder where the attack actually came from. And on that subject, without sounding too paranoid, I think that Kate and I probably saw and heard more than some people are comfortable with. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the CIA is planning to whack us because we know too much, or because we know about Scott Lansdale, or because Kate killed CIA officer Ted Nash. But you never know. So maybe we'll buy a dog and check under the hood before we start the car. You can't be too careful in this business, and you have to know who your friends are and who your enemies are. And if you can't figure that out, keep your gun oiled, loaded, and close. Acknowledgements. As in past novels, I want to thank U.S. Airways Captain Thomas Block, retired, contributing editor and columnist to many aviation magazines, and co-author with me of Mayday, as well as being the author of 6 other novels. Tom's assistance with technical details and editorial suggestions was, as always, invaluable, although he put a value on it and sent me a bill, which I was, of course, happy to pay. Tom and I met about 55 years ago, and the only person I've known longer is myself. Thanks, too, to Sharon Block, Tom's wife, former Braniff International and U.S. Airways flight attendant, for her careful reading of the manuscript and her excellent suggestions. I wish to thank my good friends Roger and Lori Bonnick for keeping me company in the North Country wilderness and for being such excellent guides through the bear-infested woods. Once again, many thanks to my friend Kenny Heeb, retired NYPD Joint Terrorism Task Force detective, for his expert advice and assistance. Also, thanks again to my longtime friend John Kennedy, Deputy Police Commissioner, Nassau County Police Department, retired, labor arbitrator, and member of the New York State Bar, for his advice and suggestions. When verisimilitude and literary license clash, license usually wins, so any errors regarding legal or police procedural details are mine alone. Special thanks go to Bob Atiyah, a private pilot with an instrument rating, who shared with me his knowledge of general aviation procedures, flight plans, SBOs, FBOs, and everything else I needed to know and had no clue about. Thanks always to my excellent assistants, Diane Francis and Patricia Chichester. There is a special place in heaven for author's assistants, and truly Diane and Patricia have earned it. And last, but always first, my fiancée, Sandy Dillingham, whom I thank for giving me the gift of a new life. I love you. There is a new trend among authors to thank very famous people for inspiration, non-existent assistance, and or some casual reference to the author's work. Authors do this to pump themselves up. So on the off chance that this is helpful, I wish to thank the following people. The Emperor of Japan and the Queen of England for promoting literacy. William S. Cohen, former Secretary of Defense, for dropping me a note saying he liked my books, as did his boss, Bill Clinton. Bruce Willis, who called me one day and said, "Hey, you're a good writer." Albert Einstein, who inspired me to write about nuclear weapons. General George Armstrong Custer, whose brashness at the Little Bighorn taught me a lesson in judgment. Mikhail Gorbachev, whose courageous actions indirectly led to my books being translated into Russian. Don DeLillo and Joan Didion, whose books are always before and after mine on bookshelves, and whose names always appear before and after mine in almanacs and many lists of American writers. Thanks for being there, guys. Julius Caesar, for showing the world that illiterate barbarians can be beaten. Paris Hilton, whose family hotel chain carries my books in their gift shops. And last but not least, Albert II, King of the Belgians, who once waved to me in Brussels as the royal procession moved from the palace to the Parliament building, screwing up traffic for half an hour, thereby forcing me to kill time by thinking of a great plot to dethrone the King of the Belgians. There are many more people I could thank, but time, space, and modesty compel me to stop here. On a more serious note, the following people have made generous contributions to charities in return for having their names used for some of the characters in this novel. James Jim R. Hawkins, who contributed to Canine Companions for Independence. Marion Finelli and Paul Dunn, Cradle of Aviation Museum. Carol Escrezi and Patty Gleason, Make-A-Wish Foundation. Gary Melius, on behalf of his friend John Nassif, and Lori Bonnick, Boys and Girls Club of Oyster Bay, East Norwich, and Leslie Scheinthal, Variety Child Learning Center. Many thanks to these caring and public-spirited men and women. I hope you've enjoyed your alter egos and that you continue to support worthwhile causes.
This has been an Hachette Audio production of Wildfire, written by Nelson DeMille, and read by Scott Brick, with a special conversation between Scott Brick and Nelson DeMille. directed and produced by Bob Dion. Post-production by Dion Audio. Production supervised by Linda Ross Korn. Warner Books is a trademark of Time Warner Inc. used under license. Text copyright 2006 by Nelson DeMille. Audio production copyright 2006 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental. And now, a conversation with the author.
Hi, this is Scott Brick. I'm currently sitting in a recording studio in Los Angeles where we've just finished narrating Wildfire. I've finished narrating it. We've just finished cutting it together. I'm joined today on the phone by the author, Nelson DeMille himself.
Thank you, Scott.
I was trying to put together a list of questions, things to ask you about this book, about this the character of John Corey. My first thought was to get to hear from some fans to maybe ask questions that they wanted to ask, but then I thought, you know, I'm reasonably certain I can speak for your fans because I'm a huge fan of your work myself. I mean, I don't just narrate your books. I read your stuff voraciously, so.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to start with a question specifically about Wildfire. In these last two books, Nightfall and Wildfire, you've placed them in very specific moments in American history. In Nightfall, you dealt with 9/11, and now you're dealing with its aftermath. And I'm curious what led you to set Wildfire in October 2002, when the book is being released in 2006.
The idea was that it was 1 year after 9/11, and you know, it's one of the first kind of questions you have to answer as an author. When do I want this book set? What year do I want it set? And also, you know, what month do I want it set? So, not arbitrarily, but with some thought, I decided, you know, 1 year and 1 month after 9/11 would be good. It's far enough from the event that it's, you know, not as immediate as it would have been if it had been a month or two after 9/11/01, but far enough down the pike that people are starting to, if not forget, at least they're starting to let it, you know, kind of let it assimilate into their consciousness. And that's how the country changed in that 1 year, and I think it's, you know, all the time frames I could have picked, I think this one works.
Mm-hmm. The recovery process seems to be fully underway. People finally assimilating what the difference is.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. The recovery process, and also, to some extent, the forgetting process that sets in right away. In America, we tend to forget tragedies right away. And we see the character of Corey, who now is more motivated to stay with the job on the anti-terrorist task force than he had been previous two books. And he's motivated at the same time, you know, his wife and partner, Kate Mayfield, who's an FBI agent, is looking out of the business, I think. You know, she was kind of shocked by by 9/11. Also, her whole thought process about the FBI. She was a good company girl in the last two books. In this book, she's starting to question the FBI, and I think this, you know, is kind of indicative of some of the changes that, you know, went on, not just in American society, but went on institutionally in some of the institutions like CIA and FBI. And I got that idea, by the way, in a book group from an FBI, a female FBI agent.
Is that right?
Yeah, who said that, you know, Kate was too much of a gung-ho, rah-rah company girl and too FBI. And that, this woman told me, you know, and something that she hadn't thought about, she said, you know, the FBI has changed since 9/11. And, you know, we're doing, it's not as structured, we're doing more questioning, and we're a little bit, you know, a little bit more, well, I guess the word would be, if not cynical, a little bit more, you know, skeptical is a better word of some of the procedures that led us to 9/11. So I said, that's a good point, and she was on the inside, so I guess some inside info there, and I changed my character of Kate Mayfield to reflect what this woman in the book group said.
You spoke in your introduction to Wildfire about the realities behind the various concepts that you dealt with in the book. I'm thinking of the ELF transmitters, the speculation that a newer version of mutually assured destruction might currently exist, etc. And I'm curious what originally sparked your interest to write this title, to write about this scenario. Was it a casual reference to any of those things that you read somewhere, or a specific event?
No, actually it was a casual reference, and I don't know where, you know, sometimes you don't know where the ideas come from, but there was something that I read in an obscure magazine, like a foreign relations magazine, and it talked about having a program like mutually assured destruction that we had with the Soviets, if they launched against us, we would launch against them.
Mm-hmm.
To do this with the war on terrorism, that if an American city was hit by a weapon of mass destruction, that without question, without even knowing the source of the weapon, we would simply nuke certain cities in the world of Islam. And, you know, because if this threat was understood by the other side, then American cities were a lot more secure. And if you think about it, I live in New York and you live in L.A., and this is, you know, target one and target two.
Absolutely.
And you think about this once in a while. And, you know, I have a daughter in New York and I have a son in L.A., and you say, God, you know, it's possible. But I think if the other side understood that an atomic bomb, a nuclear suitcase, the suitcase nuke, as they call them, going off in an American city, you know, would precipitate several American ballistic missiles being fired toward Islamic cities. Unfortunately, they would be random cities. I don't think they'd be totally random. I mean, certainly Tehran is number one on the list, and Damascus number two. So, yeah, so I took this idea and I kind of ran with it. It's sort of the war on terrorism version of an old Cold War thriller, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the Cold War. During the Cold War, and I grew up on Cold War thrillers, long before I was writing, I was reading Cold War thrillers, and they were all about, well, most of them were about nuclear Armageddon. So, you know, when the Cold War ended, a lot of people who were into the Cold War, the, you know, the Tom Clancy's and John Le Carre, it's sort of like almost out of work, but, you know, if you wait long enough, everything that's old becomes new again. So I think the war on terrorism has some similarities, you know, maybe in the real world with, you know, with the Cold War. But for the writer, I think it's just a rich minefield, unfortunately. You know, we wish it wasn't there, but there it is. And,
right. You
know, you deal with it because this is what we deal with every day. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen from day to day in this country. And then we'll think, we could have said that 10 or 15 years ago, but now we, you know, we're a country that's quite frankly worried.
Yeah, of course. You talk about things like the suitcase nukes or any of the other things that had gone into this title. I'm curious how much research you did on those items. How detailed is your research process in general? I found myself, as we were dealing with these scenarios in upstate New York, going to places like, you know, The Point or Wilma's B&B. I was wondering, did you actually go to these places? Did you go find a suitcase nuke?
Unfortunately exists, and we know that. There are about 60 or 70 theoretically missing from the Soviet arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Soviets are very advanced with nuclear weaponry. And like you see what the Iranians are trying to do now. They're trying to just build the simplest of all bombs. They've been taking years to do it. But the Americans and the Soviets were able to actually miniaturize these things. I mean, this is incredibly advanced technology. And the Soviets, you know, when the Soviet Empire fell apart, they lost control of some of the inventory, unfortunately, and there apparently are 60 to 70 of the suitcase nukes missing. And that's one of those, you know, little things you read in the papers that keeps you up at night but stays in your head. So I put that one aside, and I knew I'd use it someday. And I'm not the first one to use it either because, you know, there are all these you know, so-called renegade nuclear physicists from the Soviet Union who are willing to sell out to the highest bidder and all that.
Mm.
That research was kind of easy. There's enough written about, you know, suitcase nukes. And then the extremely low frequency, the ELF transmitter, was technology that is very, very difficult to find anything about. I had a good researcher, who I actually credit in the book, Tom Block, who's a childhood friend of mine and also was my co-author on Mayday, which I wrote about 15 years ago. But Tom is a U.S. Air pilot captain. He's currently retired, but he's very good at the technical stuff, and he got me some information on extremely low frequency waves, which there's not much known about it, not much published either. So that was kind of the most arcane piece of research in the whole book.
I'm curious, John Corey went on and on about his dislike for B&Bs. Just curious if that might reflect your own opinions.
I've been in more B&Bs than I care to remember in my life. The funny thing is that people have read the early copies of this, but oddly enough, three men, and they were all men for some reason, commented that I was right on about the bread and breakfasts, and apparently other people have had similar experiences. The ladies seem to like them. They think they're cute and you know, kind of romantic, whereas the men, I think, would rather be at a high-rise hotel with a bar.
Right. You've dealt with the Cold War very powerfully over the years. You were talking about earlier, you grew up reading these books, Cold War fiction. Whether your books were set during the war, you know, quite a few have dealt with its aftermath. I'm thinking of Spencerville, for instance. You know, it showed how the Cold War's end affected all of us, whether as individuals or as a nation. Recently, in Nightfall and Wildfire, you seem to be making a turn, talking about the conflicts that have developed in the Russians' absence from the world stage.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, do you see your future work continuing in this vein? Are you going to continue to write about international conflicts, specifically terrorism?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and Spencerville was, I'm glad to mention that, and I can say this, my least successful book in terms of sales anyway, not in terms of reviews, strangely enough, but it was meant to be, you know, a post-Cold War book. The Cold War was over, and I decided I wanted to write a book about the end of the Cold War and how it affected people. It's sort of the, you know, the Odyssey, so to speak, after the Iliad, and, you know, the war is over, and these people are now all coming home. You know, and it was done brilliantly in World War II, the coming home books, but never done well in with the Cold War, because it's a different kind of war, I suppose, and everybody didn't come home at the same time, so to speak. And the book was not successful in that for a variety of reasons, and, you know, I kind of said, well, that's the end of that, so, you know, I wasn't slow to pick up on the fact that terrorism was a problem. I mean, this has been with us since, 76, 77.
Sure.
If you remember, Harris, and I can't remember his name, but he wrote, one of the first, terrorist novels, Black Sunday.
Black Sunday, right.
Okay, so Harris, and I met the guy, and I can't remember his name, it was awful. But, the guy who wrote Silence of the Lambs, anyway.
Thomas Harris.
You know, he picked up on it years ago, a very successful book and a successful movie, too, I should say. And yet it was only dealt with, you know, in a spotty kind of way, maybe because the Cold War was still going on, and how many, you know, how many catastrophes and threats can you deal with at one time? And the Cold War seemed more imminent and, you know, bigger. And the Cold War ended, and we were kind of, like, confused. What do we write about now as novelists? And the whole terrorist thing just, you know, was there, but nobody was really paying a lot of attention to it. And so, yeah, these books, you know, my last couple of books kind of grew organically, I guess, out of, you know, the situation, which is persistent. They're not going away, and I think we all understand that now. So you can, you know, with some surety, write about the war on terrorism, and the book won't be outdated by the time it's published. But down the line, to answer your question, I wish I knew, and maybe we can talk later. Give me some ideas. I have no idea. The Gold Coast sequel, I think it's a good idea right now, because it's not about the world stage, and it's kind of a breather. And the one after, I know, is going to be another John Corey, and it has to do with, you know, terrorism. And I think, you know, and the funny thing is you can plan that far down the road about writing a book on terrorism, because we know it's going to be there, and nothing's going to change.
In the same way that there's been a shift, well, let's say, reflecting, you know, the end of the Cold War to the post-Cold War world in the subjects that you write about, there's also been a shift that I've noticed in style that you adopted. I want to say it was about maybe halfway through your career so far that you moved away from the third-person narrative that you used in By the River of Babylon and Cathedral to the first-person, and I believe it was in the Gold Coast that you used it the first time.
It was the Gold Coast, yeah, and it was... It was a liberating experience, you know. I mean, publishers and editors don't like the first person. This may not be true today as much as it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. They used to say that, you know, suicide notes are written in the first person and authors shouldn't write in the first person. So there's a prejudice against the first person for a variety of reasons. One is that, you know, only one character is carrying this whole novel. If you lose interest in the character, you know, you lost interest in the novel, obviously. And Gold Coast started off as a third-person book, but it wasn't working. It just wasn't working. The main character, John Sutter, sounded like a pompous ass in the third person. But, you know, but I noticed that his dialogue was kind of funny, and the narrative was not good. The narrative was not flowing the way it should have, but his dialogue was good. So I said, without telling my editor, let's change this book from third person to first person. I had never written in the first person before, but I'd say it was liberating. When I sat down and I started doing it, I began the first scene, you know, with, you know, I, John Sutter kind of thing.
Right.
The book just took off, just totally took off. And looking back on some of the other books, I can see a book like Spencerville, could have been written in the first person, probably would have been a lot more successful, a lot more big and dynamic had it been written from the standpoint of the main character. Some of them are definitely third-person books, you know, when the action is all over the globe and you're getting different points of view. But that's an important decision an author has to make. Do I want to write this in the first person? Am I really following one character and only seeing his point of view? So everything else around is a mystery. But do I really want to open this book up and show the reader everything that's going on, all the forces that are coming together? And, you know, some storylines lend themselves to first person and some lend themselves to third person. And it's a good writer who knows when to pick which one.
You've also been able to blend them. Wildfire, certainly, or The Lion's Game have sections of both. In The Lion's Game, as we're following Asad Khalil, it's third person. But when you're with John Corey, you are John Corey.
Yeah, that was a challenge, too. And that's a very, you know, unusual thing to do, is to switch from first to third person. But, you know, when you have a hero of that dimension, like the John Corey, you want to keep him in the first person, how he was introduced earlier in earlier books.
Sure.
And yet you want to get inside the head of the villain, because the villain becomes so important. So you got to go back to the third. I mean, I could have made Asad Khalil first person, too, but it might have sounded cartoonish because he was a Libyan terrorist, and I'm not that much into the heads of Libyan terrorists, so I just said, let me leave that one alone as a first person and do it as a third person. And he alternated the chapters, and I think it was pretty seamless. I got not one single complaint, except, of course, from the publisher's editors saying, you know, what are you doing? You know what, if it works, it works. You try to tell a story, and, you know, however you can tell a story. Sometimes I feel like I should draw cartoons sometimes on the pages to make it even easier to, you know, to visualize what I'm trying to say. It gets frustrating sometimes working with words when you can't work with pictures. And so, you know, whatever trick you can use to keep the reader interested and the reader engaged and entertained primarily, you know, you do it. And you forget the rules of writing. Forget everything you ever learned in writing class.
Throw out the bad ones, remember the good ones.
All right.
Well, Nelson, you've been very generous with your time. I've come to the end of all the questions that I had written down, but there was one thing I just wanted to share, I guess, as maybe a brief testimonial. I can honestly say that, I mean, this book is, Wildfire is riveting, but at the same time, it's absolutely hysterical. And I have never, in any book that I've recorded, I've never laughed out loud more while recording a book. You know, my director's here in the room with me, and he can tell you, I was ruining takes left and right. I couldn't get through these lines without laughing.
Well, thanks. It's a serious subject, but I know what you mean. It's, you know, the characters, it is definitely a lot of gallows humor there.
Well, I think it's even more moving because you go from such riveting drama to humor and then back again. It's very much a roller coaster ride and extraordinarily real.
Well, thank you. I think a lot of life is like that. And I was never on the New York police force, but I know a lot of cops. And, you know, during the darkest situations is when the humor comes out. And, but I saw this when I was in the Army in Vietnam, and, I saw Oliver Stone's Platoon, and he got it pretty well right, but what he forgot, and he was in Vietnam, he should know better, what he forgot is GI humor. I mean, you can have mortars coming and lobbing in at you, and, you know, somebody can make a wisecrack, because this is what gets you through the day, is the humor. And I think this is maybe a lesson I remembered from the Army, that no matter how bad the situation is, you know, Americans love humor, and somebody's going to make a wisecrack. And so I think maybe that translates into, you know, all the Corey books, which are, you know, always about kind of grim subjects, but he's kind of funny and a little bit, this is how he handles, I think, how he handles the stress. I want to say something else, too. I get a lot of fan mail, you know, through my website and also snail mail. And as I said to my secretary, I get about half of my fan mail about the audio is really Scott Brick's fan mail. People are complimenting you on the great job you do. I mean that sincerely. And I forward a lot of them on to you, as you know.
I do. I see them all. I appreciate it.
I'm saying, geez, I thought I wrote the book, but if they want to write nice things about Scott Brick's interpretation of the book, that's great, too. Yeah, but they are great jobs, and very much appreciate it. It's good when you know, people comment to me about the audio and saying, oh, God, I read it. Who is that guy? Scott Prick, he's just great. So I just wanted to pass that on to you.
I appreciate that. It's kind of you to say. Getting to do any of your books, specifically, certainly the John Corey novels, it's It's fun because it seems like an extended monologue. Most monologues are about maybe 5 minutes. These are monologues that wind up being about 12, 14 hours. And it's just such a pleasure to hang out inside these characters' head.
Well, thank you. We all wish we were that quick on our feet the way John Corey is, but as an author, you have the luxury of making time stand still. You can sit there and stare at the blank page for 15 minutes and say, what is John Corey's quick comeback? Well, a quick comeback took me 15 minutes to think about.
Right, of course.
But when you put it down on paper, it sounds pretty quick, but we're not all that nimble.
Yeah. Oh, God, if only we were. Well, Nelson, congratulations on Wildfire. It's a great achievement, and thanks very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, God. I appreciate it.
Best of luck with the new book.
Have a good day.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.